Welcome to the You and Numeric podcast. Our latest guest is Wim Nauder from South Africa, who recently joined us as a professorial fellow. So Wim, you used to work in Finland for UNU WIDER, the World Institute for Development Economics Research of the United Nations University. By coming to Maastricht, are you picking up where you left off or changing direction a little?
Yes, Howard, thank you very much. Yes, it's exciting to be in Maastricht. It's exciting because I will be continuing and picking up where I left off at UNU WIDER, but it's also exciting because coming to Maastricht, there's also a number of interesting opportunities and exciting avenues for future work that I'm really looking forward to. So, picking up where I left off, I was project director of projects that looked specifically at entrepreneurship and economic development, but also at fragility and development. And these two issues, whereas I started out thinking that, well, it will be kind of like two separate projects that I needed to juggle, it turned out to be quite intricate and very much interdependent. Mm-hmm. We find nowadays with governments finding their finances under pressure, at least in the rich world, and overseas development aid declining very significantly, and millions of young people in emerging economies entering into the labor markets, we find that the search for jobs and sustainable jobs created by the private sector and by entrepreneurs is really very much, in very high demand. And so I'm increasingly being asked over the last couple of years, what can be done to get people start their own firms, to create more jobs for other people? Also, how can we use the private sector and not necessarily only governments to find solutions for certain global problems? For why are certain countries vulnerable to climate change more than others? What can be done to mitigate the impact of natural disasters through, for instance, getting entrepreneurial incentives correct? Mm-hmm. So there's actually a very interesting terrain of research and of teaching and development that is out there. And of course, coming to Maastricht with the expertise that are there in the Maastricht Graduate School of Governance and also in UNU Merit, it really combines the focus on this innovative aspect of entrepreneurship, the need for innovation-driven growth and development, also with the fact that governments and the public sector are often finding the most intricate problems in the so-called fragile states. Mm-hmm. We have a book coming out on fragile states, and also one on entrepreneurship and innovation and development, both by Oxford University Press. And it's very interesting looking now at these two volumes that they are really talking about, on the one end, there are countries where there's rapid growth, there's high rates of innovation, firms are doing very well in developing world. But then there's also countries in fragile states where you do not find the same kind of like successful entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. And of course the question is, if you find all of this in the developing world, what lessons can be learned and how can you duplicate some of the successes in the rapidly growing emerging economies and highly innovative firms to these fragile type of states? And mm-hmm. I think this is some of the issues that I would really be interested in furthering in Maastricht.
Now, you're among the top 5% of economists in Europe, joining a top 5 global innovation institute, according to RepEc rankings. Is it true what they say about it being lonely at the top, or do you take a more cooperative rather than competitive approach?
Well, no, I don't think that it's lonely at the top. Sometimes I think that it would be good to have some lonely spots during the day when one can contemplate and think about all the interesting challenges out there. No, I think in today's world, you need to network, you need to work very closely and collaborate with different institutions. What I've always liked very much about the United Nations programs, and also what I really think the Graduate School of Governance has done excellently in the past, is the wide networks, across the world. So United Nations has always been across boundaries. It's had, always worked with people from many, many nationalities. Now we're in Maastricht. Also, I'm a research director of the Maastricht School of Management, and last week we had a graduation ceremony and we had literally had nationalities in double digits, over 40 different nationalities graduating. And that's also what Maastricht is. If you walk around campus and in the streets of Maastricht, you will meet people from across the world. It's really a mini United Nations.
Yeah. We counted about, I think it was 33 nationalities for our latest intake on the master's program.
Yes.
So it's a similar thing.
No, it's very global. And I think to sustain excellent research, high quality research in a global environment, networking for me is really very important. But there is, of course, also competition. And I think the competition is also very good. I mean, individuals are also vying to publish. We find our students also want to publish in their research. We find that countries are competing with one another, despite that they're also cooperating. Yeah. I mean, somebody has once talked about co-opetition as really the golden rule for life in a global village for firms. So they have to cooperate, but they also have to compete.
Entrepreneurs are competitive, generally.
Entrepreneurs are always thinking about, you know, it's not, you know, who runs the fastest, but who runs in front. So I think that is also very valuable to try and also be very competitive. It keeps you on your toes. And I think that applies for educational institutions as well as for firms.
Okay. Now, you're South African, and your research focuses, among other things, on the economic development of Africa. How big a stake does the EU have in Africa in terms of aid, trade and development? And if the euro implodes, how much will that affect development in Africa?
The EU has a huge stake in Africa, and I think Africa has a huge stake and interest in the EU. It has always been the case. Africa is very close to the EU, and it has a very deep historical ties. And I think that the economic situation in Europe is not very good news for Africa. I think, you know, I'm quite confident about the stability of the euro and the soundness fundamentally of the euro. One should also distinguish, you know, the ultimate fundamentals from short-term speculation and short-term uncertainty about currencies, and how speculators drive up and down different currencies. But I think what is more of a worrying fact for Africa's development is twofold. One is that growth in the euro area and in the broader Europe as well, for that matter, tends to be sluggish and is expected to be sluggish in the near future. One doesn't see a rapidly growing Europe very soon. And secondly, we see that European governments are cutting their aid budgets and their development cooperation budgets to African countries. So both the loss of trade opportunities, export opportunities to Europe, the fact that Europe is getting stricter and stricter also in terms of migration. Migration is a very important source of revenue through remittances to Africa. Aid is also for some of the poorest African countries very important, not for all, but for many. Those are negative trends that affect the development of Africa. And then one also has to take into consideration, you know, also the intellectual legacy and the intellectual advantages of proximity to Europe in terms of spillover effects of technology and innovation, of new ideas being generated in Europe, which spills over into Africa. By Europe becoming more inward-focused, you know, these spillover effects will also be lost on Africa.
I mean, you mentioned speculation and confidence. Do you think the media is actually implicated in this? And do you think they're guilty of dumbing down and shattering confidence in these troubled economic times?
It's a complex question. I no doubt think that the free and vibrant and critical media is essential for development. It's essential for science. It's essential for democracy. It's essential for development. And I think for the media providing a platform where we can discuss ideas about development, even if people come up and they have very unhelpful ideas about development, it's fine. Let them have a forum where they can put that and where this can be discussed. So I think in an open society, that's very important. Of course, we also have to be critical about the media. We will guard the guardian, so to speak. So the media has an important role, but one also has to ask critical questions, whether the media always are doing the right thing. We know that there are crises in the media. There was different scandals in the UK very recently. So we also have to realize that the media need to be scrutinized itself, that the media also consists of companies and firms that want to make a profit, and their profits are also being squeezed, you know, through advertisement and so forth, you know, within Europe and the Western world where the economies are declining. So we have to be also very careful and realize that the press can also search for stories based on, you know, how much copy that particular story can sell, you know. So is it sensationalist? And that has got a real danger that the real important development stories get lost in the noise. And also that, you know, you can create a furore about something which may not be really the most important issue that you should focus on. I mean, we've seen this during the financial crisis in 2008, that it was very quickly on all the media that the world is in a recession, which was never true. The world never went really into a recession. Yeah.
But they need to fill the slots for 24/7.
Indeed. It sounds very dramatic to say that the world is in recession, but even in that stages, there were developing countries that were notching up very good growth rates. But that creates a very negative perceptions, and it plays into uncertainty that may surround markets. So, yeah, I think it's an important question, and one needs to... but one needs also, for me as a researcher and for an institute... like University of Maastricht and UNU Merit, it's very important that the media offers a channel through which we can disseminate our research, through which we can reach decision makers who can use the research into policy making, businesses that can use that into their own management and entrepreneurial processes. And that is very clear, that's very important. But of course, the media is changing very rapidly with social media, with the internet, you know, print media perhaps being phased out or playing a less dominant role. The youthful populations across the world using different media. And so that also keeps us on our toes to develop and have a relationship with the press and the media whereby we can get our message out. And I think in that
stay
regard...
ahead of the curve.
Yeah, and staying ahead of the curve, I think there the media also is for us a very important partner to help us also to stay ahead of the curve in terms of what our target markets for our research and educational programs need.
Yeah. Coming back to your research, your latest article focused on entrepreneurship and human development, a capability approach. I'm not an economist, so can you explain in simple terms what you mean by a capability approach? I mean, is the emphasis firmly on education and empowerment, or what?
Well, the capability approach comes from amongst others, the Nobel laureate Amartya Sen, who is very famous for the work that he has done on what's broadly called human capabilities. Or, you know, how humans are functioning. And it's an approach to development which is saying that development is more than just giving people money or increasing GDP per capita. You will find that very much resonating very recently with this commission, the Saint Fitoussi Commission that President Sarkozy of France appointed to rethink the way in which we measure economic development and growth, that we are fixated on GDP per capita, and that's not necessarily what development is all about.
It's a very blunt tool.
Indeed, indeed. And Amartya Sen wrote a few path-breaking works on this in the 1970s and 1980s, in which he said, well, we have to think fully about how human beings are functioning. So your capability to have freedom is really something that is important. So what are your dimensions of freedom, of being able to make choices about your life? And that is really important. So you think about development as expanding people's set of freedoms that they have over their own lives. If they have money but they have no real choices in their life, then you can argue that they're not really developed and that they therefore lack capability. And of course, thinking about entrepreneurship, this paper that you referred to was in a special issue, which was in celebration of the anniversary of Amartya Sen's birthday, I think he's 75th. And I think it was one of the first papers that critically thinks about entrepreneurship as something that furthers human capabilities. In other words, does it increase your freedoms, your positive freedoms that you have as an individual if you are an entrepreneur? And well, we generated a theoretical model which implies that the approach that policymakers sometimes take to think that everybody needs to become an entrepreneur, that we need to push as many people into entrepreneurship as we can, that it's a positive thing for them and for the country, is not necessarily true. In fact, getting some people into entrepreneurship and pushing that too much is a recipe for underdevelopment in a country. In fact, most people do not want to be entrepreneurs, and so we need to be very careful in terms of how we see that as an opportunity to increase people's freedom. You should not be forced to become an entrepreneur. Many people in the current climate they don't have the freedom to choose between employment and self-employment. Yeah. And so they're in self-employment. They may make a success of that, but they would say, well, I was forced into this. It didn't strengthen my human capabilities in this environment, the policy choices that was affected or what happened in the external environment. So I'm forced to be an entrepreneur, and that is not what I really want to do. So the moment you also find that in some of the poorest countries that you will find very high rates of so-called entrepreneurship. Self-employment is much higher, for instance, in Peru than it is in Denmark. And the reason is that as Denmark developed, more and more people went into employment, wage employment. Only the few people stayed being entrepreneurs. I think currently in Denmark it may be 7-8% only of the population that are entrepreneurs. The rest are in wage employment, etc. While in Peru it's 4 or 5 times that amount. Now the fact that people see this as you know, taking away their freedoms if they are forced to be an entrepreneur, you also find that when you ask entrepreneurs or the self-employed how happy they are in their occupations, and in Denmark they are very happy. You survey the entrepreneurs on a scale from 1 to 10, on 10, yeah, they're very happy. You survey the same people in Peru and they're very unhappy.
Scandinavians tend to have the life-work balance pretty good.
Indeed, it's very important to look at life in that way. What gives people, you know, what really makes people fundamentally happy about their lives. Some of the entrepreneurs that are really very happy are not also happy because of the money that they make. Yeah? We think about entrepreneurs as being rich, but on average, if you really want to maximize your income over your lifetime, a better probability is to go into wage employment.
Yeah. So it's more the Scandinavian dream than the American dream.
Perhaps. Perhaps. The American dream is a very brutal form of what they call sometimes also cowboy capitalism. So you find these huge spreads in returns, and you find a small number of super rich people, entrepreneurs, and you find many, many other entrepreneurs that are really slogging it out but not earning quite a lot of money. But having said that, a lot of these entrepreneurs are also very happy, because for them it's not the money that they make from entrepreneur, it's being an entrepreneur. It's the process, or as we call it in economics, the procedural utility that they obtain from being an entrepreneur that really drives them. And very often people don't understand it when they have policies for entrepreneurs. They think they should encourage entrepreneurs to create a lot of jobs, to be profitable in their businesses, to be successful in raising finance. But for many entrepreneurs, that is not what it's all about. So I think that thinking about entrepreneurship in this way also creates some scope for perhaps changing the policy implications for how you promote entrepreneurship. I mean, recently an evaluation study of one of the biggest entrepreneurship support programs in the European Union found that the people who participated in these programs were actually then after the program less inclined to become self-employed and an entrepreneur than before the program. So the program actually had the opposite effect than it was intended to do. And I think this is partly part of the design problems if you think about...
Does that open their eyes?
Maybe it opened their eyes. Maybe they then realized that, you know, if they are going to be forced into a lifestyle choice or a occupational choice in which they have to maximize, you know, it's only about the bottom lines, and, you know, without the bottom lines you cannot really be an entrepreneur. Then maybe they think that is too much. That's not what they want from their lives. Yeah? So they don't want to organize it around the bottom line. And maybe that's something that can also be useful for a lot of development money, development aid going into entrepreneurship in developing countries, which wants to open up more avenues for people to be entrepreneurs. But you already have 30-40%, even more, of the population in entrepreneurship. They would rather want to get out of the entrepreneurship game. And so if you're going to measure the success of these programs, it's not being measured by how many people you help to become entrepreneurs, but maybe how many people you help to get out of entrepreneurship. Maybe completely turning the debate on its head and taking different perspectives. But I think it's interesting.
Okay, so it's a complex question. But welcome to Maastricht.
Thank you.
And thanks again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
Looking forward. Bye.